started discussing the four different theories of providence that the Rambam mentions in chapter 17. From, right? 17, I believe. Okay. And we did the first four, right? The first five, which go through what he considers to be from the first theory is basically that there's nothing at all, there's no hashgacha anywhere. Through Aristotle's theory that there's a hashgacha in terms of the general maintenance of the species and things that are permanent, but no hashgacha on the individual. And then he had, we'll come back to these next two in a second, but he had two theories from the Arabic, the Muslim philosophers, that basically everything is either what he considers to be all the product of God's will, or, that was one, or all the product of God's wisdom, okay? And the fifth theory that we started was what he calls that of our law, okay? And that is basically that everything is determined by not simply will, which doesn't have any idea of justice or chokhmah, and not simply chokhmah, which implies certain absurdities that we'll get back into in a second, but the Torah view, the law that he calls, the theory he calls our law, is that everything is mishpat. Okay, I just want to go over these, and then we went through the Rambam in chapter 23, where he starts talking about the text of Eov and the discussions and the back and forth, and he shows so far that we got up to is that Eov, in his complaints, was basically expressing the ideas of Aristotle. Okay, but what I'd like to do, just to give a little bit of a context to the third and fourth theory, namely the theory that everything runs by will versus everything runs by chokhmah, okay, and the absurdities that he discusses in them. And those are going to be two more positions that he says are expressed in the Sefer of Yov. I just wanted to go give a little bit of a backdrop that we that the Rambam mentions earlier. I think it'll help us to just get a clearer idea of what they're saying and the problems that they're trying to avoid, and ultimately with an idea of how we're going to avoid these problems in what the Rambam considers his personal view. Okay, because in the view in his explanation of what he calls the theory of the Torah, he's pretty. He doesn't really go, in my opinion, he doesn't dig deep into any challenging any problems in there like he challenges the other theories. And I think he really feels he's going to resolve those problems later on in what he considers to be his opinion, which, spoiler alert, happens to be the opinion of Elihu in his interpretation of Eov. So when the Rambam says, when he presents the fifth theory as quote-unquote our law, he doesn't really mean that. He means to say, I think in the Hebrew they have it like, how does that have it in English? He says, I will show you the first view expressed on the subject in the prophetic books and generally accepted by our sages. But he has it in the Hebrew, the Hamon of the Chachmei Yisrael. I think he's presenting the way it's commonly perceived. But obviously, if he thinks Elihu is his theory, and actually one of the theories that are rejected is this fifth theory, obviously he doesn't really mean that this is the true theory of the Torah, because how could it be among the rejected theories, and how could Elihu have a different theory? Okay, so
when he says Torah's view, he's just talking about how the people perceive them?
It seems so. It seems so.
Yeah,
the generally accepted. If you'd ask a regular person in Klal Yisrael, what is the meaning of all the of everything that happens, they would say mishpat, right? And they would glean that from Maimari Chazal and Psukim and things like that. But But the Rambam is going to go on to show that there's more to it than that. And there's a, and that, and in a certain sense, that's a little bit superficial. Okay, but anyway, if you take a look at what the big problem, and the Rambam says, right, and remember, he doesn't blame these people for coming up with these theories because there were big problems they were grappling with. And they tried, and although they failed, he says they weren't like evil people trying to, you know, undermine religious truth. They were faced with a very big problem, and they had to, and they made a mistake in resolving it. But the problem is real. So, if you take a look back on chapter 16, the Rambam presents the problem. Okay. Yeah. What's that? Okay, so he says like this. The principal reason that first introduced the philosophers to adopt their theory is this. He's taking it in the context of the philosophers, which he considers to have really done an evil. But anyway, for our purpose, let's just get to the problem. He says like this. Some pious men live a miserable... Okay, at first thought, we notice an absence of system in human affairs. Okay, when we first look at the world, we don't see it, doesn't seem like it's run well. Okay, some pious men live a miserable and painful life, while some wicked people enjoy a happy and pleasant life. On this account, the philosophers assumed as possible the cases which you will now hear. Okay, they said like this, there's only one of two things that are possible. Okay? Either God is ignorant of the individual and particular things on earth, and he doesn't perceive them, right? Or he perceives them and knows them. Okay? So, Naram says, and that's definitely a true statement. Right? There's nothing false about that. Now, then they continue like this. If he perceives and knows all things, all individual things, then we have three possibilities. Okay? First one is God arranges and manages human affairs well, perfectly, and faultlessly. Or he is overcome by obstacles and is too weak and powerless to manage human affairs. Okay? These are just the three logical possibilities. Or third, he knows and can do a perfect job, but he just doesn't care, so to speak. Okay? So the Rambam says, yeah. Okay. So he says, and this is also a complete enumeration of all possible cases. For instance, he says, for those who have knowledge of a thing, they either, one, take care of the thing which they know and manage, which they know and they manage it, or they neglect it. Rambam is, it's funny, Rambam is reordering the decision tree over here. Okay, he says, of those who have a knowledge of a certain thing, right, either take care of the things which you know and you manage it, or you neglect it. All right, so you definitely are not neglecting things, right? Now, he says, or while taking care of it, you have not sufficient power and strength for its management, although they have the will to do so. So those are the three possibilities, right? Either you take care of the thing, or you neglect it. And in taking care of it, you either have the ability to do what you want and do it perfectly, or there are some obstacles that prevent you from doing what you want to do. Okay? Having enumerated these different cases, the philosophers emphatically decided that of the three cases possible, so this is the Aristotle view, as regards the management of the thing, by one who knows that thing, there are two inadmissible in reference to God. So they said, we can't say two things about God. We can't say that he lacks power, or that he has no will. Okay? So, you can't say that he simply has obstacles in trying to accomplish his will, or that he has no will at all. He just doesn't care about it.
Does that be neglect chita?
That's the neglect chita. Okay. Because they imply either evil disposition or weakness, neither of which can by any means be attributed to God. Consequently, there remains only the alternative, that God is altogether ignorant of human affairs, or that he knows them and manages, or that he knows them and manages them well. Okay, so we basically have altogether, what, five possibilities, right? So we have either he's ignorant or he knows, right? And then within his knowing, he either manages perfectly, fails at managing perfectly, or neglects. Okay? So they said, you can't say God neglects. That's an evil. Can't say he fails at managing. Right? That would be a weakness. So the only thing that's left, basically, is that he does a great job, perfect job, actually, or that he doesn't know. Right?
If he doesn't know, isn't that also a weakness?
Ah, very good, Ariel. Very good. So he says, since we, however, notice that events do not follow a certain order, that they cannot be determined by analogy, right? I guess it's four things, really. They cannot be determined by analogy, and are not in accordance with what is wanted, we conclude that God has no knowledge of them in any way or for any reason. That's the argument of the philosophers. This is the argument which led the philosophers to speak such blasphemous words. Okay, and then the Rambam goes and tears into them severely because of what Ariel said. He says they were trying to avoid one evil and they went into a greater evil. Because the lack of knowledge is the greatest imperfection. Okay, but basically the other theories... Yeah. So that's what Rambam says about... He goes on to take down those philosophers. But in terms of the other theories, this is his introduction to the chapter we were doing last week. Obviously, we did out of order. And he ends off, after having shown that knowledge and providence are connected with each other, I will now proceed to expound the opinions of thinkers on providence, and then I shall attempt to remove their doubts as to God's knowledge of individual beings. But basically, from that follows the will and the wisdom people. Okay? Because they're also learning in that same vein, that God either knows everything or doesn't know everything, right? And he either manages perfectly or doesn't manage perfectly. And if he's not managing perfectly, it's either because he doesn't care or because he can't. So they also reject that he doesn't know, right? They reject that he doesn't care, and they reject that he does a bad job. So they must say he does a perfect job, okay? So if he's doing a perfect job... Well, what about all the bad things that we started out this inquiry? What about all those problems that we started this, that set us on this whole inquiry to resolve? So one theory is the will theory, and that is there is no such thing as bad by God, because it's just his will, right? And there is no hashgacha, and there are no good people, there are no bad people, and everything is just will, right? That was the, what he calls, the third theory. We were counting it as the second theory. We were discounting it first, and then the Chachma theory is also saying everything is done perfectly, okay. But they admit to some kind of free will among man. Therefore, they can't just say that God is punishing a good man. That would be unjust. So they say there's a certain Chachma that we don't know about, and that Chachma means that this good person who's suffering now, it must be for his good in the end, or he will be compensated in the end, and it'll all be worked out with wisdom how to sort of compensate for the suffering that he has now. Why does he have suffering now? Well, that's God's wisdom decreed that he should have this suffering now, and he will be compensated in the future on that. Now, this is what? Okay, the name of this sheet is the Mutazila. The Mutazila. Okay, that's the wisdom shita. The first shita is the shita before this was the Asharia. Now hold on. What's interesting is the Rambam says they go even further in their absurdities. But the point is that you were asking, we discussed last week, It's like knowledge and hashkacha are one thing, basically. Okay? Because God's knowing everything means that he is, that nothing is happening beyond his control. And therefore, every single thing that happens, we can say, is must be in line with his plan, so to speak, or his hashkacha. Okay? It's all in line with his hashkacha, and therefore we have to explain why this hashkacha is proper. So, therefore they have to say that there are these hidden things that we don't see, basically, that the wisdom is going to determine that everything is for the good of the recipient. But what's interesting is, and this doesn't seem necessary, but he says they go even further in their absurdities. What's further? We ask them, why is God only just to man and not to other beings? And how was the irrational, and how has the irrational animal sinned that it is condemned to be slaughtered? Because they believe that everything that happens is known by God, and therefore under his hashgacha. So why is this animal, why is God, so to speak, decreeing in a certain sense that this animal should suffer a death? So they go fully in this theory, and they say, okay, there must be a chachma behind that too. And they say, there must be some chachma behind that too, and this animal is clearly suffering. It must be that it too will get rewarded. But it's all one. It's all one continuous view. It's all one, wholesale picture of everything being under the direct Hashkochas Hashem, because it's under the knowledge of God, and therefore it can't. Why would it be fair? Why would God just allow an animal to suffer like that? Must be some reason. Now it's interesting. I think I mentioned last week. The Rambam says that some of the Gaonim seem to have gone for that, seems to have accepted that idea in terms of the animals.
But if they stop before that point...
And they have a certain... He's also representing within them a certain idea of Nisayon, right? Of Yisur and Shalava. And he comes back to that in the end. Hold on. Wait. So then, when he gets to our law, what he calls our law, so he breaks it apart and he says, now it's only in terms of man, okay? And each man is. By the way, the problem with that last theory of the wisdom was he says that they have like some sort of quasi idea of free will. It's not totally a pure idea of free will, because everything is known, and knowledge is also like an element of. Of Hashgacha, and they get into some difficulty with free will. But anyway, that's why he says...
The classic question?
Yeah, seems so. That's why he starts off our theory with saying free will is a basic premise. Absolute free will is a premise. Therefore, that sets the stage for possible and impossible and necessary, but there's a realm of the possible. Therefore, we need Torah, we need laws, we need... And therefore, schar and onesh make sense. And things that happen to a person are a direct result of his obedience or disobedience. And there's no such thing as God's will simply to torture a person, or God's chachma says a person should punch, should suffer, even though he didn't do anything to deserve it. And also, he says, since man, he doesn't say this explicitly, but since man, it seems, is a unique creature of Bechira, and he develops this later, that's why all of the Hashgacha is just related to man. Okay. And he mentions it in the end. He says, our law is only concerned with the relations of men. Okay. But the idea that irrational living beings should receive a reward has never before been heard in our nation. So he doesn't really spell it out when he talks about what he calls our law, because I think he really wants to elaborate on his own theory. But basically, it means to say there are two systems, essentially, right? God's hashgacha in terms of the details, in terms of the particulars, is only in terms of Schar V'Onesh. But in terms of the animals, like he said before, if a cow relieves himself on an ant, that has nothing to do with Hashgacha. Right. Okay. So anyway, so let's continue in the course that we were taking before, and that is to say, let's go back and let's use his explanation of Eov as a way for us to follow the development of these ideas. So far we have in 23, right, that Eov represents, in the beginning, Eov represents the idea of Aristotle. Okay, so let's pick up over there on in the Friedlander without the footnotes. It's on 300. Okay, so he said, right? We went through this last week, and he basically expressed the idea that God has abandoned man or doesn't pay attention to man, and he says this is one of the different views held by some thinkers on providence. And he says in the Gemara, the Chazal say Eov was basically expressing kfir at this point, but that he shouldn't be judged harshly because it was out of his pain. But the Ram doesn't really like that explanation. He says, the words of God are justified, because Hashem said to Eliphaz and his colleagues, you have not spoken to me the thing that is right as my servant Eov has. So how could he say that Eov spoke right if he also expressed terrible kfira? So he says, the words of God are justified, as I will show, by the fact that Eov abandoned his first very erroneous opinion and himself proved that it was an error. It is the opinion which suggests itself as plausible at first thought. Interesting. So Ram says, for somebody to think that there's simply no hashkacha pratis, and the world is just run in a general maintenance of the order of things, and that's why we see people, good people suffer and bad people succeed. He says that is really it's an opinion that suggests itself as plausible at first thought, especially in the minds of those who meet with mishaps, well knowing that they have not merited them through sins. And that was Eov's situation. Right? Yeah. This is admitted by all. And therefore, this opinion was assigned to Eov. So, in the Rambam's view, he seems to take the position that it's more of a story to illustrate ideas, and it's not a real occurrence, right? He seemed pretty adamant about that. So therefore he says we attribute the it doesn't really matter, he says, but the opinion is assigned to Eov, okay, because that represents the way a person should think, the normal course of a person's thinking, his progression when he's faced with these problems is to first take that position that things just happen by chance to man, and therefore Eov represents that first step. But he is represented to hold this view only so long as he was without wisdom and knew God only by tradition, in the same manner as religious people generally know him. Okay? As soon as he had acquired a true knowledge of God, he confessed that there is undoubtedly true felicity in the knowledge of God. It is attained by all who acquire that knowledge, and no earthly trouble can disturb it. So let's just read a little further. So long as Eov's knowledge of God was based on tradition and communication and not on research, he believed that such imaginary good as is possessed in health, riches, and children was the utmost that men can attain. This was the reason why he was in perplexity, and why he uttered the above-mentioned opinions. Okay, so... yeah. Let's get the text out. So he said like this. He said that how long did Eov... when did Eov have this opinion? He only held this opinion when he knew God only through tradition. Okay? Like a regular religious person. But as soon as he acquired a true knowledge of God, he confessed that there is undoubtedly true felicity in the knowledge of God. Pleasure, right? And goodness. And it is attained, that goodness is attained by all who acquire that knowledge. And if you have that, no earthly trouble can disturb it. So in other words, that's the true good. And when a person has that true good, nothing can disturb it. But as long as his knowledge of God was based on tradition and not on communication and not on his own investigation and research, he believed that such imaginary good as is possessed in health, riches, and children was the utmost that men can attain. Right? This was why he was in perplexity and why he uttered the above-mentioned opinions. And he says, and this is exactly what he says in the end. Okay, let me read you over here. In 42, in Mem Beis, Hey and Vav, he says, L'shema ozen shimatich. Okay, when he's describing how he used to understand things. Va'ata eini ro'asicha. So I used to be l'shema ozen shmatich. I used to know God through what I heard. Okay, meaning to say, the way he translates it, I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Now, so Eov is expressing in himself what the transition was. Why did he make the mistake originally, and what has resolved it? Okay. So he says, I used to know God through tradition. That's l'shema ozen shematich. I just heard about you from tradition. But now, it's eini ro'osicha. Now I see firsthand. Okay. Al kein emas v'nichamti. He says, wherefore I abhor myself and repent. Al ofer v'ofer. Because of the dust and the ashes. Okay, what does that mean, the dust and the ashes? That's a good question. A little bit of a machlokas I saw in the Mefarshim over here. But he says that is to say he abhorred all that he had desired before and that he was sorry they had been in dust and ashes. The question is dust and ashes like now like a mushal for how he views the physical things? Like now to him they're just dust and ashes and he's lamenting that he used to be attached to the quote-unquote dust and ashes. Okay, that's one thing.
Because he is dust and ashes that he made a mistake. That's what I thought.
Okay. And but he quotes this passage again, and he sat among the ashes. On account of this last utterance, which implies true perception, that means my eyes see you, it is said afterwards in reference to him, for you have not spoken of me the thing that is right as my servant Eov has. That is the next pasuk. Vayiachar diber Hashem esedvar me'ele al Eov, vayomar Hashem el Eliphaz hatimani chora api b'cho u'b'shnei re'echa ki lo dibartem elai nechona ke'avdi Eov. Okay, so let's just pause here for a minute. So what's interesting is he's saying like this. He's saying, and this is what he mentioned in the beginning, in chapter 22, right? Is that Eov is not described as a chacham. He was just described as a person who was a yorei. He was yorei chait, right? But he wasn't described as a chacham. So the point is that, and this is a very important point, he's saying, if a person is very religious, but not a chacham, he can have a very strong feeling of love of God and yiras chait and yiras Hashem, but his idea of the good is always going to be rooted in the physical. Interesting. He feels religious and he feels that it's important to serve God. But what he considers to be the real good in life, he's saying, he still considers it in some sense to be a physical good. And he feels this is the proper behavior. This is how he should act. This is the right thing to do, so to speak. But where is his source of true pleasure? He doesn't have ideas to have the source of true pleasure. You understand? So his source of true pleasure is still going to be in his possessions, nachas from his children, all of those kinds of things. You understand? Unless the person is at the level, and this is a very high level, unless the person is at a level where he recognizes, according to the Rambam over here, the true ideas about God, and that that itself is the greatest tanug, he will be susceptible to this problem, where he'll look at himself and he'll say, I'm doing all the right things. I'm totally committed to this religious life. And I'm not getting the good. Because since this type of an attachment to God is somewhat of a religious attachment, based on a traditional view, and a sense of a certain sense of superego, I mean, have to admit that, that doesn't alter his view, the reality of his view of what is good. And he's going to be in some kind of a little bit of a conflict over here that will make him susceptible to this problem. Right? Let me just find that part where he says, he says, when he's describing Eov in the beginning, he says like this. Eov, the simple and righteous man, is given and handed over to the adversary. Yeah. It is remarkable in this account that wisdom is not ascribed to Eov. The text does not say he was an intelligent, wise, or clever man. Virtues and uprightness. So those are midos. Okay. He had very good midos, especially in action, described him. If he were wise, he would not have any doubt about the cause of his sufferings, as will be shown later on. Okay, but right now he's not talking about the cause. Right now he's talking about a little bit of a different idea. He's talking about the fact that he's recognizing that he up till now he had a mistake about, he believed. See, as long as his knowledge of God was based on tradition and communication, and not on research, he believed that such imaginary good as is possessed in health, riches, and children was the utmost men can attain. Now, now I'm just trying to explain, what's the relationship between how he has the idea? What's the difference if he has the idea through tradition or through research? Right? Why is it that if he has it through tradition, he's stuck in this sense that the good is the possessions, and unless he gets it from research, he can't have a new idea? Because it means to say, by tradition means he doesn't really understand for himself the knowledge of God. And it's only that idea, it's only that experience, only that the reality of the knowledge of God can change your perspective of what the good is. As long as it's through tradition, your framework is the way you were born, the framework is this world, and you accept a certain idea, you accept a certain premise. But if you don't see it, and you don't recognize it, you're still essentially in the reality of this of the physical. But you accept that there's a certain thing that you should be focusing on, certain thing you should be doing, certain pursuits that are important, certain activities that you should distance yourself from. But you're not going to change your deep idea of what the reality and what the good is until you see God, he says, through research. Not because that pursuit of knowledge of God through research necessarily breaks down the attachments to these physical things. Yeah.
What if your tradition is the knowledge of God is the ultimate good?
Right. So that's what I think he's saying. Now, you can't. What does that mean? It's the ultimate good. So you're always going to be stuck in this idea that it's going to give you the ultimate good. But you're going to feel like it's like you're going to be a really good boy and you're going to get a lot of schar. But you still are going to be stuck with this idea that what do you enjoy? What is your real pleasure? You can't fool yourself out of those things. And you're gonna, and if you're gonna suffer, you're gonna say it's not working. Only, he says, when a person gets to the position where he can say that the true knowledge of God is the true good, and it is attained by those who acquire that knowledge, then no earthly trouble can disturb it.
So then you're saying basically is that.
That's the pshat. I mean, I think, you know, in the Otzer Tfilos, he mentions it. My father mentioned it once. You know, that's the pshat. And Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, right? They didn't take it as a tradition. It was Elokei Avram, obviously, because he was the one who found it and developed that. But Yitzchak wasn't just handed it and told it. He also went through the same process mentally himself, and therefore it was also could be his relationship was firsthand. Elokei Yitzchak. And Yaakov as well. It wasn't just I'm gonna do what my father did, I'm gonna do what my grandfather did. They were also in a certain sense their own originators of the knowledge, because knowledge is something that cannot be passed down. Knowledge has to be activated within the student, right? It's not something that can be handed over. That's why the difference in the advance of scientific technology and human perfection is so different. You know, I don't have to know how a microscope works, but someone von Leeuwenhoek discovered the microscope, and I can use it. Any generation can simply build off the accomplishments of the last generation. They don't have to rediscover anything, right? But in philosophical truth, every individual has to, so to speak, rediscover it himself. I can't simply take your perfection as a starting point from my perfection. I can take your mathematics, I can take your instruments, I can take your discoveries as a building block for the scientific, and that's the famous statement of Newton. I'm on the shoulders of giants, but that's the problem. That's why the same mistakes in the realm of human perfection, we get nowhere practically. Dor holich, dor bo. Every generation is starting over in a certain sense. Now, of course, we have the Torah, we have Divrei Chazal. But it's not going to help you unless you have to put it to work, right? You have it available, but you don't start. You're not starting ahead. You've got to recognize that, and people sometimes feel, oh, I'm born from as them. I'm already ahead of the game. It's not true. You're just ahead in the sense that you have access to things. But internally, if you don't do the work, you'll be just as low as, I don't want to pick out a group of people and call them low, but as the lowest of the low. Okay, now. Yeah. So let's continue over here. So he says like this. The opinion set forth by Eliphaz in reference to Eov's suffering is likewise one of the current views on providence. Okay, tell me if you can guess, if you can tell which view this is. He holds that the fate of Eov was in accordance with strict justice. Okay, so that's what he called before the view of our law. Eov was guilty of sins for which he deserved his fate. Yeah. Eliphaz therefore says to Eov, is not your wickedness great and your iniquities infinite? Okay, now it's interesting because in the Ramban, he did not say this about Eliphaz. And the Ramban is quoting something from chapter 22. But in the beginning, Eliphaz doesn't really... that's what's difficult with these, with the whole Eov. And the Ramban says also, it's all like mixed up and the arguments are intertwined and... But he finds Eliphaz highlighting chait. So he says, he then points out to him that his upright actions and his good ways on which he relies need not be so perfect in the eyes of God that no punishment should be inflicted on him. So basically he says, you are a sinner. Okay? Don't you have great wickedness and iniquity? And basically, you don't think you're so bad? Well, maybe in the eyes of God it's bad. Maybe in the eyes of God it's bad, and you don't realize that. Much greater than you think. He says, behold, he puts no trust in his servants, and his angels he charges with folly. Famous passage. How much less in them that dwell in houses of clay. So you think you're so great. Okay, but God's justice is very strict, and his knowledge of your frailty is great, and you maybe think you're living up to it, but you're not. And Eliphaz never abandoned his belief that the fate of man is the result of justice, that we do not know all our shortcomings for which we are punished, nor the way how we incur the punishment through them. So that's Eliphaz. That's the what he calls our law. Now, Bildad, the Shuhite, defends in this question the theory of reward and compensation. Okay, so let's see if you can remember which guy, who this is. He therefore tells Eov that if he is innocent and without sin, his terrible misfortunes will be the source of great reward. Okay? That's the what?
Montezuma.
Okay, good. The wisdom guys. Will be followed by the best compensation and will prove a boon to him as the cause of great bliss in the future world. This idea is expressed in the words, if you are pure and upright, meaning you don't deserve this as a punishment, surely now he will awake for you and make the habitation of your righteousness prosperous. Though thy being was small, yet the beginning was small, your latter end will greatly increase. This opinion concerning providence is widespread, as we have already explained it. Okay. Zohar, the Namasite, holds that the divine will is the source of everything that happens. That's the Asharia. I'm finally getting it. Okay. No further cause can be sought for his actions. That's it. Will. And it cannot be asked why he has done this and why he has not done that. That which God does can therefore not be explained by the way of justice or the result of wisdom. His true essence demands that he does what he wills. We are unable to fathom the depth of his wisdom, and it is the law and rule of this wisdom that whatever he does is done because it is his will. It is his will, and for no other cause. By the way, in the Sadji Gaon, he also has this as one of the opinions, that it's just God's will. So, now where does he see this, though, right? So far, therefore, says to Eov, but oh, that God would speak and open his lips against you, and that he would show you the secrets of wisdom, for wisdom has two portions. Know, therefore, that God exacts of you less than thine iniquity deserves. Can you by searching find out God? Can you find out the Almighty unto perfection? I'm not sure how he sees that in there, but okay. But basically, the guy's saying you can't fathom anything about God. In this manner, consider well how the book of Eov discusses the problem, which has perplexed many people, and led them to adopt in reference to divine providence some one of the theories which I have explained above. So basically he wants to say that this represents all the theories that he said before. All possible different theories are mentioned. The problem is described either by way of fiction or in accordance with real fact as having manifested itself in a man famous for his excellency and wisdom. The view ascribed to Eov, now here's a little summary, is the theory of Aristotle. Eliphaz holds the view taught in Scripture. That's with our law. Bildad is the opinion identical with the Mutazalia, while so far defends the view of the Asharia. These were the ancient views of providence. So that's basically what I want to say. I want to say Eov is basically a book that deals with the problem that we mentioned before, of people looking around and seeing the affairs of man are not managed well in their eyes. And it's taken from the perspective of someone who knows in himself that he didn't sin. So therefore, he can express this problem well. And it goes through the four prevailing theories of Hashgacha. Now, he says, these were the ancient views on providence. Later on, a new theory was set forth, namely that ascribed to Elihu. For this reason, he is placed above the others and described as younger in years, but greater in wisdom. Okay? He criticizes Eo for foolishly exalting himself, expressing surprise at such great troubles befalling a good man, meaning that's what Eov did, and dwelling on the praises of his own deeds. So that's what he criticized Eov for. He also tells the three friends that their minds have been weakened by great age. A profound and wrongful discourse, a wonderful discourse, then follows. Okay, so So for this, I think we should come back next time, because basically this is where he starts to show you. He says, if you look through it, you'll see that it's very hard to figure out. Everybody agrees it's hard to figure out what Elihu is adding. Okay, because he says, reflecting on his words, we may at first thought be surprised to find that he does not add anything to the words of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Sophar, and that he only repeats their ideas in other terms and more explicitly. He likewise censures and rebukes Eov, attributes justice to God, relates his wonders in nature, God's wonders, holds that God is not affected by the service of the worshipper, nor by the disobedience of the rebellious. All this has already been said by his colleagues. But after due consideration, we see clearly the new idea introduced by Elihu, which is the principal object of his speech, an idea which has not been uttered by those who spoke before him. Okay. In addition to this, he mentions also other things set forth by the previous speakers in the same manner as each of the rest. Eov and his three friends repeat what the others have said. Now, you might wonder why. Why is it done this way? The purpose of this repetition is to conceal the opinion peculiar to each speaker, and to make all appear in the eyes of the ordinary reader to utter one and the same view. Although in reality, this is not the case. Now, why should that be? What's the purpose of that? What's the purpose of the purpose? Why is it that he's saying the whole thing is presented in a way that's confusing to the average reader, and it makes the average person not able to really figure out what is new, what is different, and in all of the opinions. And Elihu's idea is hard to differentiate from what anybody else said, and hard to figure out on his own. Okay, I have to see if we can think about that. But from here, he goes into what Elihu's idea is. So let's leave that for now. And what I'd like to do is this part in conjunction with the last theory that we left off in the chapter on providence in 17. Because basically, they correlate. You know, he's going to try to say that Elihu is. I mean, he doesn't say it, but the implication is that Elihu is really expressing the idea that he considers to be which he says is his personal idea of the of Hashgacha. Okay, so we'll try that.